I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we talk about myths specifically related to our gardens. Do rusty nails really turn hydrangeas blue? Ciel Fenari is here to talk about her new book, Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. So good to see you.
Well, it's wonderful to be here, Mindy.
And I guess we should say the answer is no.
No, that's right. Just no. Well, that's not always the complete answer. The thing about some of these myths is they do have their, excuse me, roots in the truth.
And it kind of, you know, when you think about it, you could see where somebody might think that some rusty nails would, because of the whole metal in the hydrangeas, right?
Well, that's right. That's right. What turns hydrangeas blue is actually aluminum, and it's the pH of the soil that determines whether that plant can take aluminum up. So, but somehow that metal, you know, idea has gotten sort of warped into rusty nails. And I suppose if you dumped a huge bucket of rusty nails in and around a plant, maybe the iron might make the soil a little more acidic so that then the plant could absorb the aluminum, maybe.
But you'd need a lot.
You'd need a lot of them, yeah.
All right, so in the introduction, you talk about your interest in tracking down the bits of lore and their origins, and you started reading gardening books from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Most questionable garden advice, you say, originated in the mid-20th century. How interesting is that?
Well, I think it is interesting, and it surprised me. I expected to find the source of many of these myths in the early 1900s. And by and large, what I found in books in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and in newspaper columns from that time, was people talking about good, common sense, get out the shovel and get to work garden advice. And it wasn't until, you know, the 1940s, but mostly after 1950, that a lot of these myths started popping up. And I think part of it has to do with that's about the time that work became a four-letter word in this culture, and that ease became valued, and the quick fix, and fast food, and instant coffee. And I think some of these myths popped up because of that. People were looking for an easy way out, an easy way to solve problems.
So in the earlier books, what you're finding then is people more in touch with the natural process.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And people willing to rely on their own labors to solve a problem rather than a product to solve a problem.
One of the other things you talk about in the introduction is that, all right, be forewarned right now that you're going to link between the plant world and the rest of the modern life.
That's right. Well, here's the thing, Mindy. I know as a speaker, in order to make something sticky, in order to have people remember it, you either need to tell a story, make a heart-to-heart human connection, or say something funny. And so one of the things that I wanted to do in Coffee for Roses is to make the truth about these myths as sticky as the myths. And so I had to find a way to do that and to either link it to something that people already know about and can relate to, or something that's going to be amusing and make them laugh so that they remember it, or to tell a story about it.
There's a little bit of all of that in the book. And I love you have some little quotes, and my favorite is the Milton Berle quote, "A thing of beauty is a job forever."
That's right. That's right.
And we are going to talk about some of the myths in the book. And if listeners, if you have some garden myths that you have some questions about or stories you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear from you this morning. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, myth number one, I fell for. A perennial garden is less work than an annual planting because the plants come up every year.
That's right. I hear people all the time say to me, I'm tired of doing all that work of planting annuals, so I want to make this a perennial garden. And my response is always not so fast, because depending on which plants you choose, a perennial garden can be the most high-maintenance garden you can plant. And pass-along plants are usually more high-maintenance than any other plant.
And that's what you said. Pass along plants from neighbors or plant sales are a great way to plant a perennial garden. And you know what? I know you've probably learned the hard way, too. I learned the hard way. This is so true. But that's not true with the plants I pass along, CL, just so get people not taking those plants.
No, there are some wonderful pass along plants. That's absolutely, I think, every gardener knows that. But as local writer Stephanie Foster once said to me, she said, I have a rule, never accept a plant someone else wants to give you. There's a reason they have it to give away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My experience with pass-along plants has a little bit of a darker side, which is that they often come with other plants as ride-alongs that you don't realize are the roots or the seeds are in with the plant that you've been given. And those plants can become a problem in the garden. They can be invasive.
Like bindweed.
That's right, like bindweed.
Oh, it's terrible. It's just
like bishop's weed.
Yeah.
That's a really nasty one.
Well, it's funny because when we first started with making our perennial beds, I thought the same thing. Oh, we're just going to put perennial. This is going to be great. Took the Lily of the Valley, which now I have to, and I suppose in some ways it's if you're willing to go in there and, you know, rip it out in certain areas and keep it in a small section, it's easy enough to pull up, but other things maybe not so much.
Sure.
But yeah, the black-eyed Susan's gorgeous, but you got to be mindful of how far they're spreading,
right?
But I suppose if you know what you're getting into beforehand,
well, and frankly, the work of a perennial garden is or can be a joyful thing, you know.
Sure, it's like a meditation.
And that's right, exactly. Weeding can be a form of meditation. Being outside and just focused on the natural world is wonderful, and you see funny things, and you see miracles, and you see interesting things. Nature is unbelievably, endlessly fascinating.
That's for sure.
So the work of a perennial garden can be wonderful, but you should go into perennial gardening knowing that it does take effort, and that I often compare a perennial garden to being the teacher in a fourth grade classroom, where, you know, you have these 20 students and each one of them has a different learning style and a different home life and different talents and different problems. And as a teacher, you have to meet all of their needs and still keep order in the classroom.
Yeah.
And that's what having a perennial garden is like.
And that classroom changes year to year.
That's right. The classroom changes year to year. Every year is different.
Yeah.
That's right. Just like every class has its own complexion, every year in the garden is different.
It's so funny because when I first started with the perennial garden, and I had, you know, this beautiful like bee balm in one section, and I don't even remember, it was some sort of a sage. I thought, wow, this is going to be great. And the next year, the sage was gone. you know, it didn't make the winter, what have you. And then in spring, we're like, we're going to make more perennial gardens so we don't have to mow the lawn.
Right.
You know, it was way easier to mow the lawn.
It is way easier to mow the lawn, particularly if you don't really care whether you're mowing grass or weeds or clover or what's in the lawn.
Right.
You know, if I have a lawn that if it's green, it gets mowed and it's wonderful.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. How can you complain? But yeah, so we evolve with the perennial gardens. And I know now instead of weeding under my apple trees, I've planted hosta.
Excellent.
So, you know, there's always a solution.
There are
somewhere.
Some perennials that are weed smothering plants. Hosta is one of my favorites. Geranium macrorhizum, which is one of the crane spill geraniums, that's another favorite, that they outcompete the weeds because they grow so densely.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal, I think, in a garden is to get enough of those, but not plants that are so weed smothering that they become invasive and problematic themselves, such as English ivy.
That's a problem plant. Oh, if my husband's listening, he's nodding his head going, see, I planted some English ivy next to a fence just for the winter. And here now, a few years later, it had completely covered that fence. It was just awful. And we finally got it all ripped out. But yeah, it takes off a lot faster than you think it's going to.
That's right. You turn around and it's growing under the shingles and into your house and small children are disappearing.
All right. So here's another one. And this is one that you have a personal story with. Daffodils need to be deadheaded.
Yes, well, that story originates when we first bought a house out in the Mid-Hudson Valley, And my mother sent us as a housewarming present a collection of daffodils. And so I planted something like 100 daffodil bulbs. And we had this lovely slope every spring that would bloom. And I was told that I needed to deadhead them and take off the seed pods because the seeds rob the bulbs of energy. And so I would get out there every year assiduously snapping off those seed pods. And one year I was doing that, and a friend stopped by and she said, "Oh, no, no." She said, "You can't just snap off the seed pods. You have to take that whole stem down to the ground because the empty stem that you leave looks ugly. And so you have to cut the whole thing off." Well, my back didn't like hearing that, but I then very carefully would bend all the way to the ground and cut those stems off. And daffodils multiply, right? So what started out as 100 bulbs ended up being many hundred that needed deadheading. And then several years later, after we'd moved to the Cape, I heard a daffodil breeder speak at a conference. And I very innocently asked him how he deadheaded all his fields of daffodils out there in the Berkshires. And he laughed at me. And it turns out that not only do they not have to be deadheaded, that the developing seeds do not rob the bulbs of their strength. And in fact, many of the current daffodils that we buy are sterile. But the other thing that he told me was very interesting, that by removing that stem, I was actually taking something away from the bulb, because the flower stem on a daffodil is capable of the same photosynthesis as three or four leaves. And so I was taking away some of that plant's food production mechanism. So that was something that I could just cross off my to-do list.
So you just leave them there?
I leave them there until they start to yellow, which is usually about now, about the third week in June, they start to fall over and yellow. And then you cut them off or mow them down. Or if you've been smart and that's what my father-in-law used to do. My father-in-law used to macrame his daffodil foliage. So no, if you've been smart, you plant them in with perennials or some other plants that grow up and cover them.
Hosta
and
that's
daffodils.
That's what I did. I put them in my
hosta
bed.
Is the perfect thing, because the hostas support the daffodils when they're flowering as they're coming up.
Yep.
And then as the daffodil foliage is turning yellow, the hostas grow up
covering
over
it. And you don't have
to do a thing. Perfect.
Exactly. Tom is giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I was just calling about rusty nails making hydrangeas blue.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a 100-year-old house or older, and every time we have worked on it, it relieves. It produces a lot of ungalvanized iron nails. And I've been throwing them on our hydrangeas here, and it turns the soil more acid, and they turn a lovely dark blue late in August for us, and it's wonderful.
I would ask you, Tom, how do you know it's the rusty nails that are doing that?
Don't do it on certain plants. We have a whole turnaround full of hydrangeas.
Uh-huh.
Ones get missed. Then they don't turn as blue as the others. Of course, now we go to aluminum sulfate because it's much easier.
Right, right. Well, and many of us don't even have to use aluminum sulfate. You know, most of us have aluminum naturally in the soil. And what I think people sometimes forget to take into account is that pH of soils can vary for a number of reasons. From location to location, we always think that here on the Cape we have naturally acidic soils, but you may or you may not. Town water is often treated to be more alkaline, and so watering with town water can raise pH of soils, and sometimes even a shrub that's closer to a water sprinkler might have more alkaline soil than the shrub that gets less of that water that's further away. Areas that are closer to cement, such as a foundation or a cement walkway, can also become sweeter over time, more alkaline because of the cement leaching into the area. Mm. And so sometimes the pH of our soils varies from, 5 feet to 5 feet in our gardens just because of what's gone on around it. And we sometimes forget to take that into account when it comes to, you know, what color the hydrangeas are.
Yeah. Tom, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking with C.L. Fornari about her new book, Coffee for Roses, and 70 other misleading myths about backyard gardening. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with C.L. Fornari. Her new book is Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. Our toll-free number, if you have a myth you'd like to talk about, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Or maybe you're wondering if something you know is a myth. Give us a call. We'll see if we can figure it out for you. I've picked a lot of ones that I've fallen for, and here's another one I think many people believe is true. Plant red flowers to attract hummingbirds.
Yes, it's a common thought that red attracts hummingbirds, but it turns out that hummingbirds care about the same thing that realtors do. Location, location, location. And you can hang a hummingbird feeder, for example, somewhere, and it has those little red fake flowers on that hummingbird feeder. And if you move that hummingbird feeder after a while, 5 feet to the left or the right, the hummingbird will come to where the feeder used to be. And when the feeder isn't there, it doesn't look around left and right to see something red to go and find the feeder again. It zooms off to where it knows there's going to be another nectar source. So you want to get hummingbirds into the habit of coming to your garden, of course. And every year I plant Salvia Black and Blue, which is a hummingbird magnet in my garden, and it is blue, blue, blue. And the hummingbirds love it. So nectar is more important to the hummingbirds. Sugar content is more important to them than color.
Yeah. I have the hummingbird feeders, which are all where the glass is even red. But I've noticed, they go to the lantana, they go to the butterfly bush, they go to all different colors. So,
sure.
Yeah.
They're constantly zipping around there. One of my favorite hummingbird plants is Nicotiana mutabilis. And it is a self-seeding annual for me. And the reason that I like it as a hummingbird plant, it's a pretty plant too, but it is very frost tolerant.
Oh.
And so it is in flower when a lot of other things are gone. And it is a good nectar source for the hummingbirds that are traveling from Canada down south in the fall. And so after my hummingbirds have left, there's often a little pause. And then I will see hummingbirds coming through my garden that are on their way south.
Is there a common name for that?
No, Nicotiana mutabilis. And mutabilis is a term that means multicolored.
Oh, okay.
And what Nicotiana mutabilis does is that the flowers start out dark pink and then they age lighter pink. And so you get several colors of pink flowers, not red, but pink on the plant. Easy to grow from seed.
Okay.
It's an easy annual to grow from seed. And it's one of those annuals that once you have it, you always have it in the garden because it self-seeds and appears every year.
I'm going to look for some of that. All right, Vivian is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Vivian.
Hi. Someone asked me about getting their roses to bloom. And the lady had said that there was a housekeeper who told her that she should dig up the roses and wash the roots in a solution of dish detergent.
Oh, good grief.
I've never heard that before, and I have no answer.
Oh, boy.
That's taking cleanliness to a little bit of an extreme, I would say. I don't know why anyone would do that other than if they were... I don't know why anyone would wash the roots in dish detergent. Maybe they were mixing, you know, the idea that insecticidal soap kills insects. But roses basically bloom on new growth. And so you want to promote new growth on your roses. And the more new growth you have, the more roses you will have on those bushes. And so for that reason, we don't want to cut our roses down really short in the spring or the fall, because you're cutting off some of the new growth for the next years, and you will have, you might have shorter plants, but you will also have fewer roses. And we want to provide the best environment for roses to grow, which is nice, rich, organically amended soil. And whether you amend those roses with coffee grounds, or whether you amend them with composted horse manure, cow manure, seaweed, you know, organic material makes roses happy.
Okay, Vivian, thanks for that. So what about the coffee for roses? That's the title of the book. People think that, put the coffee grounds on
the roses.
That's
right. I hear coffee grounds and banana peels. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I think sometimes these myths arise and they get passed along, and then people try to come up with reasons why they're true. And so the banana peels, of course, people go back to potassium. Oh, bananas are rich in potassium. Well, they're not that rich in potassium that would, you know, cause the roses to grow. But they are organic matter, and roses love organic matter. And so, and it's all attracts the earthworms and the beneficial insects and the beneficial microbes. That decaying organic matter is a home for the microbes that help plants to grow. And so putting coffee grounds or putting banana peels or eggshells, that's another one you'll hear. There are a lot of breakfast foods that can go around your roses. It's all good organic matter. And my mother was a gardener who bypassed the compost pile completely. She took her kitchen garbage and put it directly into the garden. Perfectly acceptable thing to do. And she would put it mostly in her vegetable garden, and she would just kind of lift up the mulch that was in her vegetable garden, throw that, you know, kitchen garbage underneath the mulch, let the mulch go back on, and it would compost right in place. Mm. And so it was less work for her, and it added that organic matter into the garden. And certainly doing that around roses is a wonderful thing. And we sometimes, I think, as gardeners, forget that nature constantly amends soil from the top down, right?
Yeah.
Leaves, sticks, debris falling down on the surface of the soil, rotting from the top down. That's how nature fertilizes soil. And so we should take a hint.
Right. All right, here's another one. Marigolds keep bugs out of the vegetable garden.
Well, Mindy, I have to tell you that my husband and I have planted a vegetable garden together for almost every year of our marriage. There's only been a couple of years when we were, you know, sort of displaced that we didn't plant a vegetable garden. And it's one thing that brings us both great joy and pleasure. And every year we would put marigolds in the vegetable garden because we were told marigolds keep bugs away. Well, of course, we still had bugs in a vegetable garden. There, you know, it's a jungle out there, and there are insects everywhere. And so, you know, certain vegetables attract certain insects. But we still planted marigolds every year. Well, when I researched this myth, it turns out that it began back, I'm trying to remember whether it was the 1930s or 1940s, but there was a study done in the South, in any case, on dealing with harmful nematodes that are in the soil for farms. And what they did was they planted fields with certain plants, and then at the end of the summer plowed those plants into the soil, and the following year tested for harmful nematodes. The field that was planted with marigolds had a much lower population of nematodes the following year. Now, this became like the party game telephone, where one person whispers in the ear that, you know, the marigolds kept nematodes away the following year. And then the other person whispered it, and it got passed along until it became marigolds keep insects out of the garden. So the reality is that they don't, that no controlled study of marigolds and insects in a garden has shown that they have any effect with keeping insects out of the garden. But at this point, my husband and I still plant marigolds in our vegetable garden because, as he says, it's traditional. And for both of us, I think, for Dan and myself, the smell of tomato foliage and fresh basil foliage and marigold foliage. For us, that's the smell of summer.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I have never planted marigold in my vegetable gardens, and I did this year. But I plant them a lot of other places, and I thought, oh, why not? I'll just pop one here or there because they're pretty. I thought, well, just in case, you know.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, it couldn't hurt.
But the other thing I'm thinking is I recently was out in California at some of the wineries, and I noticed that some of the ends of the rose, they would have like a rose bush, or they plant the mustard. And I'm assuming this is to attract pollinators.
Flowers in a vegetable garden are a wonderful idea. And basically, on every property, the more diverse plantings you have, the better off you are. Because if you attract pollinators to the garden, you also attract predator insects to the garden. And the more diverse your insect population, the better everything is kept in balance. Right. And so, yes, absolutely. Marigolds attract pollinators, and many other plants do as well. And so planting flowers in and around a vegetable garden is a very good idea.
Yeah, sometimes I let some of the broccoli go to flower, specifically because it attracts so many pollinators. And
sure.
The same thing with some of the lettuce. Once I pull some of the lettuce that bolts, but some of it I leave because, you know, who knows who's going to be attracted to that flower.
That's right. And lettuce, when it flowers, is a very interesting plant.
Yes.
I sometimes use lettuce as a filler in either a perennial or annual planting, and I let it go to seed. And I can't tell you how many people say, oh, what is that flower? What is that plant?
Hey, Joel is calling from Brewster. Good morning, Joel.
Hi. I got some myths about eating vegetables, and one of them is about pokeweed, which is a traditional plant to eat, but everybody knew it was poisonous, so they only cut the brand new shoots coming up in the spring, and the rest of it you stayed away from, and that's all silliness. There's an alkaloid in there that can make you not feel well, but cooking temperatures destroy all of it, and you can eat the berries and the leaves. Don't bother with the root. It's a huge taproot, and alkaloid is quite concentrated in it. There are other plants like wild carrots, the Queen Anne's lace. Mostly the roots are just thin, woody, terrible little things because the soil is so bad around here. I have seen roots of Queen Anne's lace, which is a wild carrot, and has much more carrot flavor than your store-bought carrots, and the roots would be 2 inches in diameter. There would be a tough woody core down the center of that root, but this big flesh around it is just great, and you would have 3 or 4 big branches off that root. You could get a 2 pounds of carrot out
wow.
of one plant.
One plant.
You sound like a backyard forager.
Pardon me?
You sound like a backyard forager.
In that you
eat the weeds, yes?
There are things like your potatoes and your green tomatoes are myths. I had an old maid aunt in Boston. She was always leery about eating a nice ripe red tomato because she heard about the green tomatoes being poisonous.
That's
well,
right.
Yeah. Tomatoes and potatoes are such close relatives. You can graft the one on top of the other and grow tomatoes above ground, potatoes beneath ground. But you've noticed some potatoes, if they swell up, if they're just under the surface of the earth and the sun gets to them, they turn green.
Hmm.
Well, same alkaloids in there, and the potato bush has seed things that look just like green tomatoes.
Yeah, Joel, thanks. A lot of information Joel's giving us this
absolutely,
morning.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he's correct. There are as many myths about things that are poisonous or things that are, you know, edible and not edible as there are garden myths.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think I mentioned in this book is that there are more myths about gardening, I think, than there are about weight loss. And there are a lot about weight loss, let me tell you. So, and it's true, too, about poisonous plants. There's one myth I did not include in there was that poinsettias are poisonous. They are not. You would have to eat bushels and bushels of poinsettia foliage, and in order to even be irritated, you know. So some of these things, they might have a slight bit of. It's always good to be cautious, of course. It's always, but sometimes they get blown up out of proportion.
Well, it's interesting how all these have some sort of little grain of truth as to start out with, and then as you
a
say,
lot
this,
of them do.
Yeah,
a lot of them do. You know, some of the myths in this book, Mindy, they come from actually a very sweet place. You know, things like having to coat a broken limb if a tree has a broken limb, and you should coat it with something, tar or paint. And, you know, that comes from a place where we feel badly that our plant has been injured. You know, our plant has a boo-boo. We need to give it a Band-Aid.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it comes from a very well-intentioned place. But by coating that tree or that place where a limb has broken off, we're actually doing more harm than good. And this is something that we always need to ask ourselves, I think, in the landscape is, are we doing more harm than good? Are we causing other problems in our well-intentioned desire to help?
All right, here's one I never heard of. Plant peppers with a few matchsticks under each plant.
Yes, that's one I've never done, but I did have it repeated to me a couple of times. And whoever first thought of giving peppers a hot foot, I don't know. But this one is really silly, I think. And I think it's memorable, however, because it's so visual, right? You can just picture those red-tipped matches around that pepper plant, and hot peppers and hot matches. It makes a connection in your brain, and it's memorable, but it's ridiculous. I mean, that's a silly one.
Well, and that's fun because some are pretty ridiculous, and you go, really? People believe that? But and then you've got some that, like I say, I've fallen for many of the myths in here.
Me too.
Yeah, exactly.
Me too. For years, I put rocks in the bottom of pots thinking
that's one of the ones I had written down here because I've done the same thing.
That's one of the hardest ones to kill.
Yeah.
That is one of the hardest ones to kill because we have all been told that. We have all, you have to put a layer of rocks in the bottom of the pot.
For drainage.
For drainage. That's right. Well, when it comes to drainage, that's what the hole in the bottom of the pot is for, you know. And the real sort of aha moment for me on that one came when I worked in the garden center. And I realized that all of those plants that are stocked in garden centers, right, there is not a rock or a shard in the bottom of any of those pots. There is not a coffee filter or a piece of screening or a seashell over the hole to prevent the soil from going out, right? None of that. Because professional growers, professional plant people, know that layer of rocks in the bottom of pots is bad for plants, and that anything covering a drainage hole is bad for plants because the drainage hole is for drainage.
Right. All right. So we gotta remember that when we're planting. We're talking with C.L. Frenare. Her book is Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with C.L. Frenare. Her new book is Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. If you have a question about a myth that you've heard, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Along with the myths in here, you have little sections of like facts. Did you know? And this one caught my eye. Did you know why so many fragrant flowers are white? And that is something I always wondered.
Yes, yes. Well, it's interesting because many flowers that are fragrant are white, and they are most fragrant at night. And you may have noticed that about the white flowering Nicotiana. Nicotiana alata is fragrant at night. One of the simisifugas, the bugbanes, are white and they're fragrant at night.
Flower.
And that's right. And the reason that they're white is that white makes a more visible landing pad for the pollinators. But these plants are attracting pollinators that are smelling for bugs. They are not pollinators that fly during the day looking for for flowers or for nectar. They are pollinators that are smelling for plants. And so that's why they're fragrant. And the white is just a more visible place to land.
Right. And then you say some of the flowers are marked like airport landing strips, dark splotches against a light background, like on foxglove.
Foxglove, that's right. The foxglove flower has those speckles, and those are all about saying to the pollinators, this is it, come right in here.
Yeah, you know, right this way.
That's right.
Again, it goes back to what you're saying about nature being so fascinating, and just, you know, watching what's happening in your yard can be such an education in itself.
Oh, it is just, there's always something new to learn outdoors. You know, there's always something new to learn. So it's one of the true pleasures of being involved with plants and gardening is seeing these very surprising things that and ways that nature has developed and how things have evolved. And it's quite miraculous.
Sure is. Lois is calling from Marston's Mills. Hi, Lois.
Hi. Great to hear you both talking about plants and gardening. I just thought I'd share something about the roses at the end of the vineyard, at the end of the rows of grapes.
Wonderful.
My husband and I were visiting in Argentina several years ago, and we were told that the reason the rose bushes are there because they serve as a sort of canary in the coal mine,
right,
that apparently they're susceptible to the same kind of fungal diseases as the grapevines are, so they can... It will signal that there might be a problem with that row, so that they can deal with it. So
I've heard that too, and I have heard that too. I have not looked into it to know if it's true, but I have heard that. Yes.
Yeah, we've heard it. We've been to vineyards in other places as well, and we'd heard it in more than one place. So anyway,
Interesting. Lois, thank you. Thanks.
You're welcome.
That's interesting.
Good talking
and then
you,
the with the mustard plant, I looked at that and went, oh, that's so that pretty yellow flower. I thought I have to find some of that. Yeah. I thought it was so pretty.
Right.
All right. Here's another one. A large crop of acorns foretells a long cold winter.
Yes. Well, you know, that sort of assumes that our trees can be clairvoyant, that they can look into the future and know what the future holds. And wouldn't that be wonderful if it was true?
It's like the woolly caterpillar.
That's
thing,
right. Yeah. But with trees, it's what's called a satiation. Let's see if I can spit it out. Satiation strategy. And for a tree, it's all about, for every plant, it's about pushing their genetics into the future. That's every plant's mission on the planet, is to push their genetics forward, right? Well, a lot of wildlife depends upon acorns for food. Many, many animals depend on acorns. So if a tree produced just the same amount of acorns every year, those would sustain a population of deer and chipmunks and squirrels, right? And that they might tend to eat all of those acorns every year. But if a tree produces only a few acorns one year, certain amount of that wildlife will starve and die. So there will be less wildlife. And then if the tree produces a bumper crop after that, there are acorns left to sprout and grow.
Interesting.
So that periodic overproduction of acorns is all about ensuring that there will be new oak trees. And it has nothing to do with the winter. It has to do with the plant's survival mechanism. Yeah.
Since we're on the oak trees, oak leaves and pine needles make compost or soil more acidic.
This is another one that's hard to kill. And unfortunately, we do have naturally acidic soils here in the Northeast, and we also have pine and oak trees. And whether that's why people have made that connection or why it came about, I don't know. The thing is that in the composting process, pH comes to neutral or near neutral. So you could start out with a compost pile of all pine needles or all oak leaves or all coffee grounds for that matter. And once it is composted, it'll test about 6.5. Mm. So what we have to remember is that nature, of course, is amending her soils with these oak leaves and pine needles. And we very carefully rake them out of our yards and get rid of them because, oh dear, they're going to make the soil acidic. When in actuality, they are gold for our gardens and they are gold for the trees and they make good mulching and they make good soil amendments. And maybe we want to chop them up so they're not quite as messy looking, but other than that, they're good for the garden.
I love the pine needles in my garden. I'm sad when I have to try to rake some, you know, things out, and I'm trying not to rake the pine needles out. It makes such a soft, and it's so quiet when you walk in there.
Yeah, pine needles are beautiful mulch. Yeah. And in fact, some places they sell pine needles as mulch. Mm. So, and sometimes people will go knowing that pine needles make such a good mulch, they'll see where white pines hang over roadways and make a note of that, because in those locations, the white pines in the fall shed their old needles, and those are places light on the edge of roadways that, you know,
you can grab some
pine needles. Can get pine needles, rake them up very easily. Be careful of the traffic.
That's for sure.
That's right.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, here's one that I was surprised. The notion of a plant needs to be fertilized when it's planted. I thought everybody thought that you need to fertilize it when you plant it.
Well, there are certain things that we kind of have come to do automatically. And we forget, in terms of fertilizer, we forget that sometimes it might be necessary and a good idea, but sometimes not. And for a plant out in the woods and the fields, there's no little fertilizer fairy out there sprinkling, you know, blue liquid. So nature does not do that other than with organic matter. And sometimes it's to our benefit to fertilize, but not always. Mm-hmm. Not always. Well,
yeah, when you're planting the bulbs and they say, put the bone meal in there, it's like, hey, squirrels, deer, come here. There's a buffet happening right over here.
Well, and you know, throwing something in the bottom of a hole is kind of a little bit of a waste anyway, because if it's just in the bottom of the hole, the roots grow out from that area very quickly. So far better if you are fertilizing and in most cases using hopefully an organic fertilizer, but far better to put it on the surface of the soil in a wide area rather than in the bottom of a hole, so that it then provides that fertilization, first of all, from the top down, which is how nature does it, and second of all, over the area where the roots are going to be growing into. That makes more sense.
The other thing I found interesting, because, you know, we don't like to have to pull all these weeds all the time. You know, a few are okay, but sometimes we just get crazy with the weeds. But direct watering reduces the amount of weeds.
That's right. Well, there's a book called Weedless Gardening by Lee Reich. And what he does in his vegetable garden is, first of all, he never turns the soil, because in the soil, in everybody's soil, there are weed seeds that are little ticking time bombs just waiting to be exposed to the light to trigger their germination. So by not turning soil, you avoid exposing those weed seeds and triggering their germination. And he also direct waters, you know, in his vegetable garden. And so then there are areas that the surface of the soil does not get watered, and fewer weeds grow as a result.
Makes so much sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Barbara is giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I hope you can hear me on this phone.
Yes, we can hear you.
I'm a seasonal. I live at the Cape for 7 months a year. And this year when I came back, all of my rose bushes had been devoured by insects. And I never remember that happening before. Like, they're just pathetic.
Well, I'm sure.
And I think if it has something to do with climate change.
Well, I think it has to do with winter moth caterpillar. And this year, the population of winter moth larvae was greater than it has been in the past three or four years. So winter moth is a introduced pest. It wasn't always on the Cape. It's been here for, I think, about 10 years, something like that. And the larvae love roses. They love maple trees and fruit trees, and they love roses. And many people did see an increased population this year. And, you know, it's just as the winter moth larva disappears, we get hit by a second larva on roses, which is the rose slug budworm. And that is just, is still feeding in some places. So it could be that you had a double whammy this year. And because of weather conditions, both last fall when the winter moths were mating, and this spring, the populations in some areas were greater this year. Yeah.
Barbara, I feel your pain.
Okay, if I just may add something. I've reached the point where I have some very nice volunteers in the garden of plants that I grew like maybe 10, 15 years ago, and they're just spreading, and they're doing well. So I think I'm never going to plant anything again. I'm just going to let these very hardy volunteers take over.
Yeah.
They're green, they're beautiful, the birds like them, and I don't have to work.
There you go, Barbara, that sounds great.
I think that sounds like a strategy that works for you, and go for it.
Yep. So. Thanks for the call, Barbara. Sandra is calling from Harwich. Hi, Sandra.
Hi there, Mindy, and thank you very much for having her on. She's
yes.
very good.
I
have two questions. One is a lasagna garden. I made one of those several years ago. A raised bed garden. I don't know how to restore it after years. You know, it tamps down.
Yes.
So it started out being, you know, having a lot of good things in it, and I don't have any idea what's happening.
Well, you would just continue basically doing what you did when you started. For those people who are unfamiliar with the term lasagna gardening, it means making layers of organic matter and soil and not turning soil up, but just making these layers and then planting in the layers. And for an existing garden, I would just, you know, put a layer down of compost or composted manure in the spring. And if you feel like you need more soil, certainly that, but it's mainly adding organic matter, because the reason that any layered garden sinks is because the organics break down. And you could add chopped up leaves in the fall on the surface, and you could, you know, you could be putting your own homemade compost there. And just keep adding every year, which is a good advice, actually, for raised beds in general, is to keep layering that organic matter down.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, yeah. Sandra. Thanks for the phone call. I've got another silly one. This one just made me laugh out loud. Beat a non-blooming plant with a rolled-up newspaper.
Bad plant. Bad plant. That's right.
Where did that one come from?
Well, that one came from the myth that shocking a plant can bring it into flower. And sometimes people will see, for example, that the year after a hurricane or some event, a plant will produce a lot of flowers. And sometimes it might have to do with the fact that it had gone through a stressful situation, or it might be coincidental, right? So people have reported that wisteria in particular, which can be recalcitrant about flowering, that you should shock it in order to bring it into flower. And sometimes that, you know, certainly cutting roots of a wisteria for some people does work. The basic thing about wisteria is that it will certainly grow a ton of foliage. And so convincing it that the end of the world is near and it has to hurry and make seeds in order to, you know, keep its kind in existence can help. But for most plants, flowering depends on other things. For a tree, for example, it has to do with maturity. Nothing will make a young tree come into flower before it's gone through its juvenile period. So sometimes it's too much shade.
All right, we only have about 30 seconds, but Joan in Chatham wants to know if it's true that red pepper, cayenne pepper, sprinkled around the cherry tomatoes keeps rabbits, et cetera, away from the plants.
Red pepper can, but keep rabbits away from the plant. You have to keep applying it. Red pepper, cayenne pepper is very effective as a squirrel repellent. But for rabbits and a vegetable garden, the best thing is fencing. chicken wire.
Sale Fenari, her new book is Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. Sale, thanks so much for coming in. So good
Thank
to see you.
It's been a pleasure, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.